Comey is fired, the House repeals Obamacare, and a special election in Montana. That ought to be a beaut. A lot more to investigate on The Political Junkie. I'm Kenny Rudin. President Trump fires FBI Director James Comey in the middle of investigating his administration's ties to Russia. Democrats smell cover-up.
If the administration had objections to the way Director Comey handled the Clinton investigation, they had those objections the minute the president got into office. But they didn't fire him then. Why did it happen today?
Meanwhile, Democrats say Republicans will pay the price in 2018 for their health care vote. A former congresswoman remembers a tough vote she took in 1993 that ended her career.
All of us now, especially the ones who came in with Clinton, responsibly, we've got to vote for this. So I was a little numb, and I had to be taken out through the tunnels. I knew that it was going to be a bit of a press rush.
Plus, what better way to celebrate Harry Truman's birthday than by talking to his grandson?
I said, "Mom, did you know that Grandpa had been president of the United States?" And she said, "Yes. Just remember something. Any little boy's grandfather can be president. Don't let it go to your head."
It's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike
for president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, because they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 178 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. Everybody had a reason for not liking James Comey. Trump and the Republicans were angry when the FBI director announced last July that there was no reason to continue the investigation into Hillary Clinton's emails. Clinton and the Democrats were furious when Comey decided to reopen the investigation 11 days before the election. And since the inauguration, Comey had been looking into any relationships between Trump officials and Russia, including Michael Flynn, and whether Moscow tried to influence the election. A lot of things that made the administration nervous. Still, no one could have predicted what happened on Tuesday. Here's David Muir on ABC's World News Tonight.
There is breaking news coming out of the White House. President Trump has informed FBI Director James Comey that he has been terminated and removed from office.
In his letter to Comey, the president said, "You are hereby terminated and removed from office effective immediately. While I greatly appreciate you informing me on three separate occasions that I am not under investigation, I nevertheless concur with the judgment of the Department of Justice that you are not able to effectively lead the Bureau." The White House had no further comment Tuesday night. Democrats had their own theories and questions. Here's Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer.
The first question the administration has to answer is why now? If the administration had objections to the way Director Comey handled the Clinton investigation, they had those objections the minute the president got into office. But they didn't fire him then. Why did it happen today?
And Schumer suggested there was only one solution.
Deputy Attorney General Rosenstein sat in the Judiciary Committee and promised to appoint a special prosecutor at the appropriate time. That time is right now. If Deputy Attorney General Rosenstein does not appoint an independent special prosecutor, every American will rightly suspect that the decision to fire Director Comey was part of a cover-up.
This story is still developing at the time we're recording this, but we'll have much more on the Comey firing on next week's show. Before Comey, the big political story was last week's passage by the House of the American Health Care Act, the GOP's effort at repealing and replacing much of Obamacare. The vote was a tight 217 to 213, with 20 Republicans voting against the measure and zero Democrats voting for it. For President Trump, it was a big win.
I feel so confident. This is a repeal and a replace of Obamacare. Make no mistake about it. Make no mistake. And I think most importantly, yes, premiums will be coming down. Yes, deductibles will be coming down. But very importantly, it's a great plan. And ultimately, that's what it's all about.
Democrats, led by House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi, saw it differently.
This vote will be tattooed to them. As I also said, they will glow in the dark. They were, I don't know, duped into walking the plank for a bill that will not become law.
The bill now goes to the Senate, where it will most likely end up looking far differently than it does now. And that process could take months. I'm not exactly sure how I felt about Hillary Clinton's sit-down interview with Christiane Amanpour last week at a Women for Women International event. It was before a live crowd of clear admirers, and Clinton was often eloquent about women's rights and misogyny and sexism and equal pay for equal work. These are important issues. But Amanpour had other questions.
Were you a victim of misogyny? And why do you think you lost the majority of the white female vote? The security moms, the people who want to be protected from the kinds of challenges you're talking about right now.
Right. Well, you know, that the book's coming out in the fall.
Just to give you
a tiny little preview, yes, I do think it played a role. I think other things did as well. Every day that goes by, we learn more about some of the unprecedented interference, including from a foreign power whose leader is not a member of my fan club.
She also asked Clinton how much of the defeat was her own fault.
He had one message, your opponent, and it was a successful message: make America great again. And where was your message? Do you take any personal responsibility?
Oh, of course. I take absolute personal responsibility. I was the candidate. I was the person who was on the ballot, and I am very aware of, you know, the challenges, the problems, the shortfalls that we had. Again, I will write all this out for you, but I will say this: I've been in a lot of campaigns, and I'm very proud of the campaign we ran, and I'm very proud of the staff and the volunteers and the people who are out there day after day. And it wasn't a perfect campaign. There is no such thing. But I was on the way to winning until the combination of Jim Comey's letter on October 28th and Russian WikiLeaks raised doubts in the minds of people who were inclined to vote for me but got scared off.
Now, I do happen to think that Comey interference and the Russian hacking did make a difference. But given Donald Trump's problems, why in the world was the race so close to begin with? Why did Clinton stay out of Wisconsin and focus on other states where she had less of a chance? Was she a very tight and scripted candidate? Was she tone deaf in taking hundreds of thousands of dollars from Wall Street firms? Could she have been more forthcoming with her answers about her email server and the Clinton Foundation? I say yes to all of the above. Still, I think liberal provocateurs such as Bill Maher crossed the line when they say things like,
okay, you had your shot, you f***ed it up, you're Bill Buckner, we had the World Series, and you let the grounder go through your legs. Let someone else have the chance. This, to me, the fact that she's coming back, it just verifies every bad thing anyone's ever thought about the Clintons, that it's all about them.
Yeah, I'm not sure I agree with him. But, you know, it's strange, sad even, that after all these years, many of us still couldn't wrap our arms around who Hillary Clinton really is. I'm hoping that in her new book, we get a little more Hillary and perhaps a little less protective shielding. Boy, how do you come up with a related trivia question after that? Okay, how about this? We know that Clinton twice sought the presidency but never won. Who was the last major party candidate who ran three times but never won? Send your answer to trivia@krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia@krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question later in the show, so stay tuned.
You know, if you break my heart, I'll go, but I'll be back again. I told you once before goodbye, but I came back again.
Last week, by a narrow margin, the House passed the American Health Care Act, as Republicans promised they would. And while the GOP was pleased, the Democrats, in defeat, almost sounded jubilant, sensing that it's a bad bill and the Republicans will pay the price in the 2018 midterms. In fact, many of the Democrats were serenading their opponents. If that tactic sounds familiar, it should. On August 5th, 1993, the House was voting on President Clinton's budget bill, a deficit reduction package that called for huge tax increases on the rich. Every Republican had voted no, as did 41 Democrats. One more no vote would have killed the bill. One Democrat, still undecided, Marjorie Margolies, a freshman from a heavily GOP district in the Philadelphia suburbs. She was torn, but she got a telephone call from the president. "You've got to vote in favor, or it will go down." And so she voted yes. And Republican members of the House serenaded her. "Hey, hey, goodbye," they sang to her. "Goodbye, Marjorie," was heard throughout the chamber. And they knew what they were talking about. She was defeated for re-election the following year. Marjorie Margolies is here to talk about that vote and that time. Marjorie, aren't you excited about coming on The Political Junkie and reliving those wonderful memories?
Oh, yeah, I love you. Yeah. This is warm and fuzzy for me. Let me take us back, because there were things that I didn't like in the bill, and there were things I liked in the bill, but mostly they never address entitlements, and I think addressing entitlements to this day is very, very important. So when I walked into the House, they said the president was on the phone, and what I said to him was, "I know how important this is. We as Democrats came in with him. It was his signature piece of legislation, and I will not let it go down." I didn't say that I would be a yes vote, but I would not let it go down. In other words, in the House, if it's a tie, 217 to 217, then it goes down, and in the Senate, the tie is broken by the vice president. There had only been two votes like that in history. Do you know what they are?
I do not.
You're a junkie. You've got to know what they are. One was the impeachment of Andrew Johnson, and the second one was the draft. So I knew that the chances of its being a tie were pretty remote. But I also knew that it was my responsibility, well, anybody's responsibility, to make sure that this piece of legislation, because it was very important and it turned out to be extremely important, would not go down. And that's what happened. I didn't make any promises that I would never raise taxes or anything like that. I just thought it was very responsible. And I was very surprised when I got there to figure out how many people were interested in staying and often not doing things that were responsible and tough. Yes, you represent, but you also have to show a little bit of leadership. I mean, that's where I was.
But here's the thing that to this day surprises me. I mean, you won a seat. The last Democrat who won that seat in Congress was in 1914. I mean, that was the last time a Democrat won the seat.
16, yeah.
Well, I think they lost it in 1916.
It was the early part of the 1960s.
Right. When you and I were both kids.
Right.
Okay. But here's the thing. I thought you had no business winning that seat. There was a popular Republican retiring after 24 years. There was a popular Republican county commissioner who was widely expected to take the seat. You were not supposed to win in 1992, and you did. And so what I still think of to this day is that, why was it left to a vulnerable Democrat in a solidly Republican district? Why was it left to you to cast a tie-breaking vote?
I feel the same way. I felt the same way then. I said, this is crazy. You're really coming to me? You will lose this seat. It's, for all intents and purposes, never been a Democratic seat. You're going to lose it. And I was on the House floor with Ray Thornton, who was President Clinton's representative, and he would not vote for
it. Ray Thornton from Arkansas, right.
Yeah, and chairs of committees wouldn't vote for it. And I'm thinking, the leadership should not be putting me in this position, but I was.
So President Clinton called you right as you got onto the House floor, or right before you got on the floor?
As I was walking in to vote, yes.
And do you remember, I mean, this is 24 years later, but do you remember how you were feeling when you cast that vote? Did you say, oh my goodness, I'm doomed in 1994, or I'm doing the president a favor, or this is the right vote for the country, or all of the above?
I was kind of numb, actually, but I thought, this is silly. all of us know, especially the ones who came in with Clinton, responsibly, we've got to vote for this. So I was a little numb, and I had to be kind of taken out through the tunnels. So I knew that it was going to be a bit of a press rush, all of you guys out there, all you crazy guys. And even when I had my meetings with constituents, I had to be taken out sometimes by the police. It was just, it was crazy. The other thing is, I don't know if you remember Bob Walker. Bob Walker was the one who was jumping up and down saying, bye-bye, Marjorie. And I didn't know this until the next day.
The Republican from Pennsylvania, right.
Right. And he was right. And he was a jerk. And he was a very, very good jumper.
Well, you know something, and you, it's interesting when you talk about those media folks out there. That used to be you, right? You were, for years, you were a local TV reporter. You were one of us. And then you became one of them.
Right. It was an interesting switch. Yeah, I had done a lot of stuff, a lot of reporting with NBC. I was in Vietnam. I mean, I did quite a bit of reporting before I was asked by a very small group of women to run in a Republican district. Actually, I have a lot of children, and I had always said to them, you know, you can't win if you're not prepared to lose. So I decided to run.
You say a lot of children. You have 11 children. You want to explain that?
Yeah, I adopted two kids before I got married, who are old people with children now. And then I married somebody with kids, and then we had some kids, and then we became the legal guardians of a refugee family that lived with us for 20 years. By the way, all wonderful, amazing people. One of them is an anesthesiologist now. And with a refugee family, we became their legal guardians. So they're 11 kids.
When you ran in 1992 against John Fox, I still remember your slogan. You said, I'm pro-choice and John Fox is multiple choice. I do remember
right.
that. I love that. But I mean, with 11, within a close race, I mean, 11 kids, my goodness, that could turn the election right there if they could all vote.
Right. They could not. But yes. The narrative was interesting.
So back to my other question, though. Do you remember thinking at the time that, okay, I think I just ended my political career?
You know, I thought that I could fight. Let me say parenthetically, it's pretty hard. It's pretty difficult to lose a congressional seat. I managed to do it. I thought that I could fight for it. I didn't realize that it was going to be the year of Newt. I didn't realize that it was going to be the Republican takeover. And of the women who, there were 24 new women who came in 1992, and a third of those women, many of them coming from marginal districts, nobody came from my kind of district, they all lost.
Well, you know, I mean, to this day, and I've spoken to you in the intervening years. You were on our program during the Democratic Convention in Philadelphia this summer, which I just loved, and I appreciate that. To this day, you still sound proud about your vote. And I'm just thinking, I know I have a piece of clip, a tape here. Years later, in 2014, when you were seeking to return to Congress, this was part of your commercial showing clips of you back in the day on C-SPAN.
I wasn't thinking about whether I was going to be reelected. I did what I think was right. I am not here to be popular. I'm here to lead.
You know, I think of that vote and I think of, you know, what's going on in Congress today. This will probably be your defining moment. You remain proud of your vote? It sounds like I was about to ask you, was this a profile in courage? And that sounds melodramatic, but...
No, I really do think it was the right thing to do, and I hate to even sound that way. It was the right thing to do. I think that too many members of Congress are interested in staying and not interested in doing the right thing and are interested in figuring out how they can be covered by what they do. I mean, just think of the Republicans in Congress voted for more than 60 times over the last 7 years to repeal Obamacare. We all said that they were lucky that obsessive compulsive behavior is covered under Obamacare. It's nuts. And then not to have a piece of legislation ready and respectable when they then came in is astonishing to me. It's just the real astonishment is that there isn't a nonpartisan effort down there to get things done.
Well, every time there's a vote that calls upon a member, he or she, to vote his or her conscience, I'm saying this from the bottom of my heart, I always think of you.
Oh, thanks.
And that vote in 1993.
Thank you. That's so nice. I do have to tell you my favorite statistic, which I may have told you before, and that is that politicians are respected at 9%. And colonoscopy is at 10%. Okay. You can cut that one out.
Maybe not. Marjorie Margolis served one term as a Democratic member of Congress from a historically Republican district in the Philadelphia suburbs. Her vote in favor of President Clinton's budget package cost her seat in 1994. And, oh, I didn't mention this. She's also Chelsea Clinton's mother-in-law.
Yes.
How do we bury the lead on that one?
And I didn't ask for that when he asked me to vote for it.
That's right. You vote for this thing, and I'll let your.
Exactly. I had my right. Firstborn. Yeah.
Marjorie, it was absolutely wonderful having you on the program.
Oh, so lovely visiting you too.
Please don't mistake me or try to make me the shadow of anybody else. I ain't the him or her you think I am. I'm just trying hard to be myself. Society's goal is to be part of the whole. It may sound good to you, not to me.
Both political parties have circled May 25th, 2017, on their calendars. That's the date of the special congressional election in Montana for the seat formerly held by Ryan Zinke, who gave up his seat in his second term to become the Secretary of the Interior. Given all the attention that was received by special House elections in Kansas and Georgia last month, I'm expecting the one coming up on the 25th is also going to get top billings. Unlike the seats in Kansas and Georgia, results in this district, which encompasses the entire state of Montana, could be more competitive than most. And that has given Democrats hope. Mike Dennison is the chief political reporter for MT Television Network, based in Helena, and before that, a 23-year veteran of covering politics for Montana newspapers. Mike, it's great to have you back on The Political Junkie.
Well, thanks for having me.
Aside from stealing what could have been a serious Senate candidate for the Republican Party in 2018, Trump's decision has opened up a House seat that's being described as an early litmus test for the president and which is making the GOP nervous. So tell me, who are the candidates and should the GOP be nervous?
Well, the candidates are Greg Gianforte is a Republican candidate. He ran for governor last year and lost in a narrow race against our incumbent Democratic governor. Mr. Gianforte is a wealthy businessman. He started a software development company in Bozeman about 27 years ago and sold it in 2012 for $1.8 billion to Oracle. He and his wife, I think, made about $300 million in change on that sale. And he's been active in Republican politics, but just last year was his first run for office. And the Democrat is Rob Quist, who is a musician. He's 69 years old, never run for office before. And he just kind of came out of nowhere to be a candidate. He's a co-founder of this kind of iconic Montana band called the Mission Mountain Wood Band, and he's performed all over the state. He's pretty well known amongst people who are 50 and older. I don't know about below that. And then we also have a third candidate, a libertarian. His name is Mark Wicks. He's a rancher from north central Montana. And whether Republicans should be worried, maybe not.
Even before you get to that, given the fact that for the most part special elections get national attention, and of course with no incumbent running, maybe the outside party has a better chance, why didn't the Democrats come up with a more well-known candidate, a more seasoned candidate?
You know, that's a really good question. That's a question that people have been asking here. I don't think there really was a clear choice of an experienced candidate. There was one candidate, Amanda Curtis. She's a state representative from Butte, a mathematics teacher. She ran in 2014 against Daines, kind of got drafted at the last second when the sitting candidate bowed out, the sitting Democrat bowed out after kind of a scandal, and she got beaten pretty good. She actually competed for this nomination, but lost to Quist. And there's been some mistakes made by Quist. Some people, I'm sure, are thinking, hey, maybe she would have been better. But the race is kind of tightening.
Now, I asked you earlier about should the Republican Party be nervous. Should they?
I don't think they should be nervous, but they appear to be a little bit. I always thought that it was a really long shot for the Democrat to win this race for a lot of reasons. Until about a week or so ago, I thought that the Republicans pretty much have it in hand. But Donald Trump Jr., who was out campaigning for Gianforte a couple weeks ago, has been called back. He's returning to Montana this week. And the Vice President, Mike Pence, is coming to Montana on Friday. And those two things kind of indicated to me that the GOP has seen some polling that indicates that maybe they haven't got this thing nailed down, so they want to bring in the big guns and make sure they win this thing.
Donald Trump carried Montana by a large margin in 2016. Is he still popular?
I think so. You know, he carried the state by about 20 points over Hillary Clinton, and I think that he remains fairly popular in the state. Although, you know, the women's issue marks in D.C. just a few days after the inauguration in Montana, the one here drew 10,000 people, which was kind of a surprise. So you just don't know. I mean, and I've had friends tell me they've been driving around the state saying, boy, we're seeing an awful lot of Rob Quist signs all over the place in rural areas as well as urban areas. So, maybe Quist has a better chance than all of us jaded reporters think so.
How was the recently passed health care bill by the House? How's that playing in Montana?
You know, that is an issue I think that is definitely going to help Quist. There hasn't been a lot of coverage of it yet. You know, the earlier bill was covered fairly extensively, and you know, everyone in the state was saying, you know, this is not good for Montana because it's going to perhaps chuck people off Medicaid. It's going to undercut a lot of people. Our uninsured rate went way down under Obamacare, and this is going to reverse that. This latest one, there hasn't been that much coverage, although Quist has come out strongly against it and kind of needled Gianforte for saying that he didn't know how he'd stand on it. Then later on, he was caught on tape telling some donors that he kind of supported it.
I noticed, you know, you talked about Mike Pence coming in and Eric Trump Jr. Bernie Sanders is coming in for Quist. I saw that, too. Does Bernie Sanders, I know what he means to the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, but how does he play in Montana at large?
Mr. Sanders won the Democratic primary during the presidential race. I think he's fairly popular among Democrats and among some independents. We haven't heard for sure when or where Mr. Sanders is going to be. I have heard that, you know, that they were negotiating with him, they meaning the Quist campaign, on what he was going to say, that they didn't want him to come in here and just bash away on Trump and Republicans, that they wanted to temper his comments. But like I said, we have not yet heard when he's going to be here, and there's only 2 weeks until the election.
I know that whenever you have an election that has national consequences and gets national attention, often the ads turn negative and nasty. Here's an ad, a very nasty ad, I think, attacking Gianforte.
There's a pattern here. Millionaire Greg Gianforte, caught not telling the truth. The press says Gianforte has a tendency to talk without having the facts. Official court records prove he sued to eliminate a fishing access spot next to his mansion, but now wants you to believe he supports public lands. The truth? Gianforte bankrolled groups that want to sell off our public lands to the highest bidder. Greg Gianforte, ignoring the facts, not telling the truth.
And here's one attacking Quist.
Rob Quist may be entertaining, but on the issues, he's out of tune with Montana. Quist supports a government health care plan even more expensive than Obamacare. More government control, fewer health care choices, higher taxes, and more spending. And with terrorists on the march, Quist supports devastating cuts to America's military budget. Rob Quist, too liberal and out of touch for Montana.
Mike, these are pretty negative ads, would you say?
Yeah, those are very representative of what we're seeing. We're seeing the National Rifle Association, the Congressional Leadership Fund, the Republican National Committee, and Gianforte all running ads bashing away on Quist. And on the other side has pretty much been Quist himself. I haven't seen any help he's gotten yet. But those themes you heard in the ads are very common themes that have been replayed again and again in ads on both sides. The public lands issue, Democrats are bringing up constantly and saying that Gianforte is an enemy of public lands and supports groups that want to sell it off, which is not really true. I mean, Gianforte has come out and said, hey, I am opposed to selling off any public lands. And the whole fishing access lawsuit thing is way too complicated to get into. And the rap against Quist, of course, is that he's one of Nancy Pelosi's buddies. She's appeared in almost every ad I've seen from Quist. There's Nancy Pelosi right next to him saying he's a liberal, and the bit about health care had to do with some comments he made saying he supports a Medicare for All system, but he's not saying how he's going to do it.
Wasn't there also something about his personal finances or something?
Oh, yeah, that too. There's been a lot of coverage on some problems that he's had with some past debts that he didn't pay. And we've written some stories, and obviously opposition research has been done, and Fed reporters have been writing stories about it. And what happened was, he, according to Quist, he got in some trouble with some medical bills because he's uninsured, and couldn't pay his property taxes and couldn't pay another debt. He has since paid all those debts off, but he's kind of weaving it into the story about how the medical system is screwed up.
Have you seen any polls?
I have not looked at them specifically, but I have read about a couple in the last week. We've had one from Gravis Marketing that had it 45-37, 45 Gianforte, 37 for Mr. Quist, 5 for the Libertarian. Then we also had the Heart Research Group. They had it 44-38 in favor of Gianforte, and they said among it.
Heart is a Democratic polling group, right?
That's correct. They poll for the Senate Majority Super PAC. They had it 44 for Gianforte, 38 for Quist, and among enthusiastic voters, they had it down to 48-47. But I don't know if they had the Libertarian in there or not. But, you know, these polls have, if they're accurate, I think they're kind of confirming what we've been hearing, that the race is tightening a little bit, but the Gianforte still has a pretty good lead.
Mike Dennison covers politics for the MT Television Network. Mike, it's great having you on the program again.
Thanks. I enjoy doing it.
Sunday is Mother's Day, where we honor, remember, and cherish moms around the world for the sacrifices they made and the unconditional love they give us. Some of us are fortunate to still have our moms in our lives. Some are gone, but will be in our hearts forever. And with that sentiment in mind, I'd like to replay a segment we ran on The Political Junkie 2 years ago. If you're a political junkie and it's Mother's Day, how could you not think of Yvonne Brathwaite Burke? A California Democrat first elected to the House in 1972, she became the first member of Congress, man or woman, to give birth to a child while in office. She was delightful to talk to, and I thought it'd be appropriate to replay some of that interview. Congresswoman Burke, thank you so much for being on the program.
Just delighted.
So you were first elected to Congress in 1972, and in 1973, along came your daughter, Autumn. Tell me what that was like.
It was very, very exciting, very chancy, because, of course, first of all, most people didn't think members of Congress had babies, and most people didn't think women who were in those positions should dare to have a child.
So not long after you came to Congress in 1973, you're pregnant. That has never happened. And did members of Congress treat you differently? Did the Speaker of the House treat you differently?
The Speaker of the House was great. I have to say, for the members of Congress, they were all very, very understanding. They accepted the idea that I was there, and I was there and working hard. I was introducing legislation. The only thing that really happened that was unusual is that I had a very controversial amendment that was on the floor, and it was a huge debate. Who would come up and debate against a pregnant woman on the floor of Congress? And there was a lot of debate about that.
You had to get a special, I guess, some permission or something from the speaker to get maternity leave. I think that never happened before in history. Look, there's nothing more beautiful than the thought of pregnancy and giving birth. But combining that, we're in Congress where there's not so much beauty anymore. That had to be just a special time.
It was a special time. And you know what? I can remember sitting in committee meetings, and if I was uncomfortable, the person next to me would say, you know, I can tell you're kind of uncomfortable, but you're doing a good job.
Did you ever get any negative comments from any members?
Not to my face. Of course, there were lots of jokes. They had lots of jokes that some people told me about them. But to my face, everyone was great. Republicans, Democrats, women, men, everybody was just wonderful. It was really like she almost had 434 godfathers. They gave me an event, I won't say a shower, before I had the baby, and they gave her a gift of silver dollars. It was wonderful.
Now, this is 1973. Her name is Autumn. And whatever happened to Autumn Burke?
Well, Autumn Burke went on to become a businesswoman. She graduated from college. She went to Oxford one summer, and then she was a real estate broker and involved in energy. She now is a member of the California legislature, and she is really doing very well there.
And she's 40-something years old. How is that possible?
She is 41, yeah.
When we political junkies think of Mother's Day, somehow Yvonne Brathwaite Burke is always the first person I think of because she made history. You made history in 1973, and I wanted to honor you on this upcoming Mother's Day.
Well, thank you. And I'm so pleased that so many more women have followed, had children there, brought their children, and moved on. My daughter has a child, too, and she is out there doing it.
Only 9 women in the history of Congress have given birth while in office, and you were the first.
That's great, isn't it?
Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Nice to talk to you.
That was Yvonne Burke, a former 3-term member of the House from California, who made history in 1973 by becoming the first Congresswoman to give birth while in office.
Take good care of my baby. Please don't ever make her blue. Just tell her that you love her. Make sure you're thinking of her in everything you say and do. Take good care of my baby. Now don't you ever make her cry. Just let your love surround her. Paint a rainbow all around her. Don't let her see a cloudy sky.
It's time to reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question. We chose this topic to acknowledge the fact that WESA, Pittsburgh's public radio station, is the latest to carry the Political Junkie program. And so the question was, who was the most recent presidential candidate born in Pittsburgh? The answer, Rand Paul. The senator from Kentucky, a 2016 Republican presidential candidate, he was born January 7, 1963, in Pittsburgh. Here's another fun fact. His father, former Texas Congressman Ron Paul, a Republican presidential hopeful in 2008 and 2012, was also born in Pittsburgh in 1935. And the randomly selected winner is Andrew Scarifile of Glencoe, Illinois. Andrew wins the coveted political junkie button. And we have a Scuttle Button winner as well. That's that waste of time contest where you need to take a word or concept from each button I post and then come up with a familiar saying or slogan. We started off the last contest with a Van is the Man button for Michigan Senator Arthur Vandenberg, a presidential hopeful in 1948. Then came one that said Ella Grasso for Secretary of State. She was from Connecticut. Finally, there was one that showed President Jimmy Carter and New York City Mayor Abe Beame, neither of whose name was illustrated, shaking hands. So when you combine Van and Ella and shake, you kind of get Vanilla Shake, which I love, not as much as Vanilla Malted, by the way. But I know that not everyone agrees with me on that, and we'll find that out in a few moments. Anyway, oh, sorry, the randomly selected winner is Bruce Gerhardt of Omaha, Nebraska. As always, check out our website for the latest political blogs, scuttlebutton puzzles, trivia questions, and the Political Junkie store. Go to krpoliticaljunkie.com.
Double chocolate malted.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Double chocolate malted for
yeah,
me.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, double chocolate malted for
yeah,
me.
It's time for This Week in Political History. Harry Truman was born on this week in 1884. He fought in France during World War I, was elected as a county court judge, a U.S. senator from Missouri, a surprise choice as President Franklin D. Roosevelt's running mate in 1944, and then, less than 3 months after the inauguration in 1945, became the 33rd president of the United States, following FDR's death. There have been some outstanding books written about Truman, most notably by David McCullough, but I thought we'd take a different approach on the Political Junkie this week by chatting with Clifton Truman Daniel, his oldest grandson. He's also the son of the late presidential daughter, Margaret Truman, and her husband, Clifton Daniel. And he's the author of Growing Up with My Grandfather, Memories of Harry S. Truman, published in 1995, and Dear Harry, Love Bess, Bess Truman's Letters to Harry Truman, 1919 to 1943, which was published in 2011. Clifton Truman Daniel, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Thanks, Ken. Thanks for having me.
Well, you know, you were 15 years old when your grandfather died, and I mean, is it fair to say that when you saw him as you were growing up, you didn't talk much about politics? Did you even know he was the president of the United States when you were a kid?
I did, but not until I was 6 years old, and I had to find out in school. My family didn't tell me. I went to school one morning in the first grade, and my teacher asked me, wasn't your grandfather president of the United States? And I said, I don't know. I went home that afternoon and asked my mother. She loved telling this story for years. I dropped my book bag at the door, and I marched across the living room, and I stood in front of her, and I put my hands on my hips, and I said, Mom, did you know that Grandpa had been president of the United States? And she said, yes. Just remember something. Any little boy's grandfather can be president. Don't let it go to your head.
And she probably knew that she was the daughter of the president of the United States, right?
Yeah, I hope so.
What are some of your favorite memories? Like, I mean, did you talk to him much? Was he around much? I know, I mean, like, were you living in Washington, right? Or were you living in Missouri? Where were you living?
No, we're living in New York.
New York. Oh, that's
yeah,
right.
Born and raised in New York. And my grandparents came to visit us in the early days. And then as we got a little older, we would go out and spend holidays with them. It's like any family where the parents and grandparents live in separate cities. You know, we would travel back and forth. And, of course, as my grandparents got older, we more often went out there to make it easier on them.
Well, your grandmother, Bess Truman, died nearly 10 years after her husband. Did she share stories about your grandfather? Was she approachable on this at all?
She was very approachable. She was a great grandmother. You know, every time my mother said that there was a toy we couldn't have because it would put our eye out or snap our fingers off, my grandmother would wait until she walked out of the room and ask us how many we wanted.
Grandma, that's exactly what grandmothers
do,
right?
So, no, she was a great grandmother. She had a great sense of humor. But around her, there really wasn't, we didn't talk about history or politics or her life. We were there to visit and have fun and go out to a restaurant occasionally and stick around the house.
Did you get a lot of information from your mom? I mean...
No. You know, now that you ask the question, I don't know why. I don't know why not. I have vague memories of learning. You learn all of this in school. So I go to history class and something would come up about Grandpa in that period in history. And I went home and asked my mother and father, is that what happened? And they would just confirm or deny. There wasn't really any big, long discussion about it. They weren't around a lot either. My father, at the time, mid-60s when I was in grade school, Dad was the managing editor of the New York Times. So he was working a lot. And Mom had her own career on stage and on radio and television, so she was gone a lot. So there really wasn't a whole lot of interaction.
Well, it's one thing growing up with Harry Truman as your grandfather, but I'm guessing it's probably a completely different learning process when you wrote your books, like, you know, first about him and then about Harry and Bess's letters to each other. What did you learn?
I had more fun and learned more from writing about my grandmother's letters because that's a period in their lives and their marriage that I wasn't around for, A. And B, it's been written about, but they didn't have those letters. Historians and researchers didn't have my grandmother's letters. She burned most of them. My grandfather came home one day in 1955 and found her throwing letters into the fire, and he stopped her and he said, what are you doing? And she said, I've read them all several times. And he said, yes, but what about history? Haven't you thought of history? And she said, oh, I have. And kept throwing letters in. She was very private. She guarded her privacy. She missed the 184 letters in the book just because she tucked them in a drawer, put them in books as bookmarks. She just forgot about them. But they hold together a bit, paired with his letters. They gave me a nice picture of what their lives were like when he was a county judge in the 1920s and early 30s, and then as a senator in the 30s and early 40s. And these letters were written back and forth between the two of them, so you have them talking to each other, talking about family members, friends, my mother, expenses, all of that stuff. And it makes a nice portrait of my grandparents as newlyweds and then on sort of the political, if you will, the political apprenticeship, my grandfather's training ground, the Jackson County courts, which was more, it's an administrative position. It's not a legal judge, a county commissioner. So as a county commissioner in Jackson County, and then as a United States senator.
Was it a great love story?
Yes. Grandpa met my grandmother when he was 6 and she was 5. Met for the first time in Sunday school. The first day that my great-grandmother took Grandpa to enroll him in Sunday school. And he saw my grandmother in the classroom and fell in love with her then and there. And as far as anyone can tell, never looked at or pursued another woman. It took her a little longer. They went all through school together, and she knew him, and they were friendly.
Women are like that. They do take it a little longer.
Well, they were very different. She was the granddaughter of one of the wealthiest guys in town. George Porterfield Gates had a milling company, Queen of the Pantry Flour. He built that big house that's now, it's called the Truman Home, but it was the Gates home. And he built that house, and she was sort of the top tier of independent society. Plus, she was very athletic. If anybody in my family has athletic ability, it comes from my grandmother. She could throw a ball as hard and fast as any boy. She could whistle through her teeth. She played golf. She played tennis. And I hear that she had a mean uppercut, too, if you got crosswise with her. But Grandpa, of course, had those very thick glasses. He couldn't take part in sports. He was a sort of a shy, bookish kid. And they were friendly, and they knew each other, and they were classmates. But Grandpa did not start courting her until 1910, which would have put him at, what, 26 years old? Or not a little younger than that, but still.
When I think of the book about the letters, I mean, they end in 1943, and, you know, of course, the next couple of years were so much different. He was vice president. He was the unexpected president. The decisions about dropping the bombs. I mean, was there no correspondence during those years, or do you think those are the ones that just wound up in the fire?
Those are the ones from her that wound up in the fire. There is correspondence from my grandfather to her. The Truman Library has 1,361 letters that he wrote to her between 1910 and 1955 or 59. And we only have those 184 of hers back. So she did, and we know that she wrote him as often as he wrote her. So we're missing more than 1,000 of her letters.
You know, I know this is ostensibly, not ostensibly, I know this is about celebrating your grandfather's birthday, May 8th. But I mentioned your mother, and of course, as you say, she was a celebrity in her own right. I found this fun interview she did with the Washington Press Corps back in the day. All the reporters were women. Listen to some of the questions.
A cheerful reply for all in this intimate quiz contest.
After 25 concerts, Miss Margaret, could you summarize for us what you've learned about singing and about people?
I think I've learned a great deal about singing, getting audience reactions to various songs. Now, I always did think people were nice, but after I've been on this tour, I know they are. They've been wonderful to me.
Well, and having done this tour, what are you going to do next?
I'm going to have a little fun and take a vacation.
Margaret, I see you're going in for the new look. You like it, don't you?
I like it in moderation. I think this is about right for me.
How do you like the Secret Service men following you around on tour?
Well, they follow me on tour, but they don't go with me on my dates.
Do you want to take a bet on that?
Oh, I'm positive they don't. I put my foot down on that in the beginning.
Margaret, have you had a chance to ask your father yet about his famous crack, "I'd rather have grandchildren than a prima donna"?
I haven't seen him about that yet, but I will.
She sounds like she's having so much fun.
Yeah, it sounds like Mom. It's amazing how much, of course, she is much younger. But it's always fun to hear her voice when she was in her 20s.
Well, you're talking about Bess Truman and the famous uppercut. And when I think of fisticuffs, and now I think of this, there's that famous story where your mom gave a singing performance in 1950. I mean, I know you know the story inside and out, and that she got roasted by the Washington Post critic. And your grandfather, who was still the president, wrote back the following. I've just read your lousy review of Margaret's concert. I've come to the conclusion that you are an 8-ulcer man on a 4-ulcer pay. It seems to me that you are a frustrated old man who wishes he could have been successful. When you write such poppycock as was in the back section of the paper you work for, it shows conclusively that you're off the beam and at least 4 of your ulcers are at work. Someday I hope to meet you. When that happens, you'll need a new nose, a lot of beefsteak for black eyes, and perhaps a supporter below. Now, I think, I don't know. I was going to say maybe your grandfather wasn't joking, but did that turn out to be a fun story in your family?
Oh yeah, that was one of the earliest and most often repeated stories.
I love it so much.
It always comes up when I give a lecture. Somebody always asks that question. And of course, you know, Paul Hume, the critic, and my father and my grandfather put that aside in later years, the animosity. So I don't know how much he was kidding about that. He was angry. He was genuinely angry. His oldest friend and press secretary, Charlie Ross, had died at his desk the morning of my mother's concert. And plus, he was dealing with the Korean War at the time. He had a very short fuse occasionally. And that just hit him the wrong way. And he wrote that letter and asked the head usher to take it out of the mailbox. The controversy blew over, and Grandpa correctly predicted that the mail would be 80-20 in his favor. But his staff nonetheless gave him a mailbox afterwards, a little brass mailbox that had the word in at the top and the word incinerator at the bottom next time he wanted to send one of those.
If he were president today, he probably would have been limited to 140 characters, right?
God. I don't know. I think my grandparents, you know, with all the letters, the writing back and forth, I think they would have loved texting maybe and email, being able to communicate with each other, and cell phones, being able to communicate with each other immediately. But I think tweeting would have been a little too brief for Grandpa.
In 2012, you made a visit to Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the two Japanese cities on which your grandfather ordered the dropping of the atomic bombs at the end of World War II. That had to have been an emotional visit.
It was, and I'm actually writing it's a Japanese form. I'm writing with a Japanese friend of mine, a writer named Kinue Tokudome, and she has been writing a lot about the treatment of U.S. prisoners of war by the Japanese, and actually has helped arrange trips back to Japan and apologies from some of the Japanese government officials and companies that imprisoned and enslaved U.S. servicemen during the war. She and I are working on a piece in tandem through email talking about the both sides of this, the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki and the treatment of U.S. POWs. And she asked the same question. She said it had to have been emotional. It was, but not in a way that's easy for me to explain. You know, my overall feeling was just of making sure that I was doing the right thing, that I was representing my grandfather and my country correctly, and yet I was paying the proper respect and empathy to the survivors and to those who did not survive Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
If you were a historian and not a grandson, how would you rate Harry Truman?
About where he is, I guess. I keep making the joke that I think the most often in the last few years he's been ranked as number 5 among historians behind Washington and Lincoln and both Roosevelts. And, of course, you know, our family's point of view is, you know, we're hoping that somebody finds some dirt on Lincoln or Washington so we can move Grandpa up. Not likely.
Clifton Truman Daniel is a former director of public relations for Truman College in Chicago, a former editor of the Morning Star and Sunday Star News in Wilmington, North Carolina, and he's the oldest living grandson of the 33rd President of the United States. Clifton, it was so delightful having you on the program.
Thanks, Ken. Likewise.
It was 133 years ago this week, on May 8, 1884, when Harry Truman was born in Lamar, Missouri. You're listening to This Week in Political History on The Political Junkie.
America needs you, Harry Truman. Harry, could you please come home? Things are looking bad. I know you would be mad to see your favorite man fell upon the land you love.
That's it for this week's show. Be sure to check out our website for much more political content and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. It's all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to ken@krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie.
Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week. Oh, oh.